Hey, y'all. We could keep eating, but I'm actually going to start the Q&A time for a few minutes. Just a few questions before we start session two. No, this is my cell phone number. If you want to text in anonymously, 601-573-5602. I won't share who it is, but if you want to text in a question, I'll read it into the microphone and Dr. Duncan will answer. But also, if you're up for it and a few brave people would like to just ask a question, I can run and kind of give you the microphone so the question can be recorded, and then Dr. Duncan can answer for us. But just a few minutes before we start session two and start out with a general question, what are a few theological issues that lay people need to know in the American church? Just maybe two or three.
Well, one important issue is under the general rubric of what is called prosperity theology. And you've seen televangelists, and perhaps you've even in your own community encountered local churches that teach something like that if you have enough faith, that God will bless you materially. You know, He'll give you great relationships and success in your life. And you just have to have a positive attitude and ask Him for these things and have faith, and your life will be great. And even in churches that don't formally believe that prosperity theology, sometimes it's called health and wealth gospel, it's called various things. Even in churches where there's not a formal affirmation of that, it's amazing how that has impacted the general evangelical world. You know, if you love Jesus, your life will be better. Whereas if you look at the Bible, sometimes it's in the very context of knowing God and loving God that you face the biggest trials of life. And so that's a huge error and a huge problem. You know, the idea that if I love God, everything's going to be pretty good in my life. And so that when stuff goes wrong, people then have faith crises. Oh, no, what happened to me? So that's a big issue to be aware of. John Piper has done about a two-minute video on why he hates prosperity theology, which is you can Google it and get to it quick. It's a good 2 minutes to spend. I mean, he diagnoses everything that needs to be diagnosed in that time. There have been a number of good books written on the topic, but that's a big issue in the church today. Yes.
Off of that and talk about the way that Christians sometimes talk about blessings. Mm. If someone gets a new car, like, how blessed am I to get a new car? Like, were you blessed to get a new car? Is that just good circumstances?
Yeah.
Is that the way
that's good. And when I go through drive-thrus in Jackson, I love it when people tell me to have a blessed day. You know, that's kind of a nice thing to happen. But I suspect that comes out of church experiences where there are a lot of emphases on blessings. Obviously, we want to acknowledge that everything in our life that is provided is a blessing from God. We don't deserve it. So often, the wonderful things that we have in our life, we hadn't done anything to earn those things. And so that's a good thing to acknowledge God as the giver of every good gift. That's a very biblical thing to do. But what often happens is people only look at material blessings or good things as blessings. And, you know, very, very often God's blessings can come in very surprising shapes and sizes and forms. And that's one of the things that Christians often learn in the Christian life, that very often we look back and things that we really didn't want in our life, God has used to be a blessing to us. So you don't want to have a superficial view of blessings. That's what you're getting at. I agree with you. I think sometimes people have a superficial view that, you know, I got a new Mercedes, what a blessing, you know, as opposed to, you know, I have a child with an illness that child is going to struggle with for the rest of his or her life. and not being able to see the blessing that God is going to work even in that circumstance. Deep and painful blessings sometimes that come along in the Christian life. So that's an important issue connected with that whole idea of health and wealth gospel, the idea that if you love God, know God, have trust in God, everything will be good in your life. Another very important issue in the church today is really, what is the gospel? You know, there are a lot of churches where the gospel is sort of be nice. I think I saw one of the ministers here, I don't know if it was David Strain or whether it was one of the other ministers here at First Pres, emphasize that the gospel is not a nice man standing in front of nice people and saying, be nicer. But look, in many churches, that's exactly what's preached. Be nicer. And that's not the gospel. I think people are really confused about what the gospel is. A lot of them think that the gospel is be good or try harder or do better. When, in fact, the gospel meets us precisely at the point where we can't do anything about our worst problem. You know, our worst problem is us. You know, none of you are old enough, except for the Deers and me, to remember the Pogo cartoon. And there's a famous cartoon where Pogo says, we have met the enemy and he is us. And, you know, we are our biggest problem. And that means because we are our biggest problem, we can't do anything about our biggest problem. We need somebody outside of us to help our biggest problem. All the religions of the world and all the philosophies of the world say we have a problem that is outside of us, and the way to fix it is inside of us. But Christianity says we have a problem and it's inside of us, and the only way it can be fixed is by somebody outside of us. But there are a lot of people that are just confused about that. And so it's super important that you're in a church where the gospel is being preached, that while we were yet sinners and could do nothing to save ourselves, Christ died for the ungodly. You know, we had a problem inside of us, our sin. The solution was outside of us, Jesus. And God has done what is necessary to make us right with Him. So confusion over the gospel is a huge, huge issue in churches today. Even churches that view themselves as having a high view of the Bible and being fairly traditionally Christian and evangelical and, you know, believing in the work of the Holy Spirit, you can find confusion about what the gospel is. So that's a big issue in the church today. And in connection to that, just understanding what it means to be justified by faith. You know, to be counted righteous, not because of what you have done, but because of what Christ has done. That's sort of Protestantism 101. I mean, that was Martin Luther's big message. And so as Protestants, we ought all to know and understand that, but it's just amazing. And, you know, the Bible hasn't been consistently preached in evangelical churches for the last 40 years or so, partly because churches thought that the best way to reach out to a world that wasn't interested in religion was not to preach the Bible, because they weren't interested in the Bible. And so the whole tack was, well, let's talk about relationships. You know, do anything, then get together on Thursday night and talk about God. Because people aren't interested in God, they're interested in relationships, or they're interested in practical, day-to-day living kinds of things. And what's happened in a lot of churches, even where they do believe in Jesus, and they do believe in God, and they do believe in the Bible, they're not teaching things like justification by faith. And that's huge. Not only for knowing the way of salvation, it's huge for assurance. So there are tons of Christians today that struggle with assurance because they don't know that the security of their salvation does not depend upon them. It depends upon Jesus. But if you don't understand justification, you want to understand that. So those are two or three issues that people see today, Chuck.
We had a few more questions texted in, and keep texting them. I'm trying to combine kind of general themes into one question. But this question, how do we know God is revealing himself to us in our prayer time? How do we keep from reading ourselves into the Bible or into our prayer and focus on God as he is revealed?
I think all of us read the Bible existentially. I'm going to try and combine the answers of those two questions too, because they go a little bit of a different direction. All of us existentially read the Bible. We're not able to completely abstract ourselves from our personal experience when we're reading the Bible. And I think the trick is what you don't want to do is try and read your opinions and your circumstances onto the Bible. You want to make sure as best as possible you understand what the Bible is saying so that it forms your opinions and speaks to your circumstances. It's a good thing for the Bible to speak to your circumstances, and it does. But if you impose your circumstances on your reading of the Bible, you'll actually mute the Bible's ability to speak to your circumstances. And so the first thing you want to know is, what is this passage saying, and what's it saying about God, and how then does that speak to where I am right now? And I think a lot of times, for instance, if you're one of those people who's wrestling with how can God be sovereign and in control of everything and I not be a puppet? How can I be humanly accountable and have a will that actually chooses things and God is sovereign? If you start off your approach to the Bible with that question in your mind, and you decide on your answer to that question, and then you start reading the Bible and you come to passages that really sound like God is in control of every incident in life, and you say, well, that can't be what that means because that's not what I think. Well, you may find out that, well, actually, that is what that passage means and what you think is wrong. So you want to make sure that you go to the Bible and you ask it to help form your opinions. And also that you go to the Bible and you're willing to say, I don't understand this. That's how the Ethiopian eunuch got saved. He was reading Isaiah 53, and Philip came along and he said, hey, buddy, I'm reading this passage and I don't understand this. And Philip says, well, funny that you ask. Let me tell you what Isaiah 53 is about. And boom, what happens? The guy gets saved. So don't ever hesitate to say, I don't understand this. There will be, Joe will love to talk to you. David will love to talk to you. Will love to talk to you. There'll be lots of people around here who would love to talk to you when you don't understand something. So I would just say, go to the Bible. It will speak to your life and to your circumstances, but make sure first you understand what it's saying. And then the application of it will follow on that. With regard to your prayer time, I would say this. Prayer is talking to God and asking him for things that are in accordance with his will. And that means that even before you start your prayer life, you need to know the Bible a little bit. Because if you're going to ask him things in accordance to his will, where do you find his will? In the Bible. So here's my one piece of advice. Most important piece of advice for anybody, anywhere, in all of the human universe for prayer is learn to pray the Bible. Learn to pray the Bible. And if you are praying the Bible, you will find that God will reveal himself to you as you pray because you are praying what he has revealed himself about himself to you.
Well, we had three or four questions, actually, about what does it mean to worship God in spirit? Mm.
To worship God in spirit means to worship God as He is. He is Spirit. So if you're going to worship God who is Spirit, the only way you can worship Him is to worship Him as He is, and He is Spirit. The little Child's Catechism in its olden version used to say, in answer to the question, I'm trying to think of which question this is. Anyway, it says, God is a spirit and has not a body like man. That's the old answer to the question. And so when we say we're going to worship God in spirit, one thing we mean is we recognize that we cannot see God, we cannot touch, taste, or smell Him, and therefore we cannot worship Him based upon our own opinions or presumptions or ideas. All of our worship is based on what He informs us with. And so the God is a spirit, and we must worship Him in spirit and in truth. That's almost like a repeated idea in different words. There's a technical term that scholars use for that. To worship God in spirit is to worship Him in accordance with His truth, because He is spirit. So if God is spirit, the only way you can approach, the only way you can even get an idea of Him is if He reveals Himself. Another way of thinking about this is to go back to the first and second commandment. The first commandment is only worship God. The second commandment is don't make images of me. Now, have you ever thought, okay, if you're only going to give 10 major rules, why is number two don't make images? That's a weird command. I mean, I get don't commit adultery. I get don't murder. I get don't lie. I get don't envy, you know, but don't make images? You got to be kidding. You spent one of your 10 commandments on that. Why? Well, here's why. Because if we make images of God, then we are forming the conception of who God is. God is not forming our conception of who He is. We make an image of Him, then we're creating what He's like instead of learning what He's like. You know, it would be like a guy in a relationship who wants his girlfriend to be a certain way. And you're waving a flag in front of him and saying, you might want to, like, listen to her and kind of learn about her some, because the way you want her to be is not like she is. And you might want to learn who she is from her instead of you developing her in your image. It's the same thing with God. You want to learn who God is from God. You don't want to. So that's why we worship Him in spirit. He's a spirit. The only way you know a spirit is if He reveals Himself. Where has He revealed Himself? In the truth of His Word. Jesus will say later in John, sanctify them with truth. Your Word is truth. So if you're going to worship God in spirit and truth, you're going to worship Him in accordance with who He is as He has revealed Himself to you.
And last question before we move on to session two. If God made us in His image and God is incapable of sin, then why is man capable of sin?
Yeah, I was talking to Dr. Penn about this at the break too. And you know, the question of why would God have created Adam and Eve with the capacity to sin? You know, why not create them in a perfection that could not be sullied? You know, so that we didn't have to go through all this stuff, you know? And the short answer to that question is, I don't know. Now, I mean, I'm serious about that. It is one of the most profound questions that has ever been asked theologically. The greatest theological minds of the last 2,000 years have wrestled with that question. In fact, it's such a profound question that sometimes skeptics will say, that the idea of sin in this world disproves the existence of God. Because if God is all-powerful and he's all-good and there's sin in this world, well, then either he's not all-powerful because there's sin in this world, or he's not all-good because there's sin in this world. But the fact of the matter is, the problem of evil is a harder problem for unbelievers and skeptics than it is for believers. Why do I say that? Because to believe in evil requires that there be an absolute standard of good and evil, right and wrong. And you can only have that if there is a creator who has established the absolute standard of right and wrong. And if you don't have that, then you have to say, when you look out at this world and you see the horrible, horrible things that happen, you have to say, that's not evil. It just is. You know, so I read this afternoon, you know, I have the little Twitter feed that pops up, and it gives reports on various sports things, and an NFL athlete was arrested and sentenced to 18 years in prison for drugging and raping 16 women. Now, if there's no evil in this world, because there's no God in this world, then what happened to those 16 women wasn't evil. It just was. Now, you know inherently when somebody says, that's not evil, that they're wrong about that, that it is evil. But the only way you can have that is if you have a God who has an absolute standard of right and wrong. So the problem of evil is actually a bigger problem for unbelievers than it is for believers. But let's go back to that question again. If God's good and God is sovereign, why did he create Adam and Eve so that they could fall and sin and evil can come into this world? Theologians have pointed out a couple of things that come from the writings of the Apostle Paul about this. And one of the things that Paul points out is God's grace to us in the face of our sin reveals something to us about his glory. God's grace to us in response to our sin reveals something to us about his glory. There is a unique presentation of God's goodness and glory in his forgiving sinners and saving us from our sins. Now, you know, you can tie yourselves in knots as to how that relates to the question, but it's the closest thing that Paul says in terms of answering the question, why would God have done this? He makes this argument from Romans 9 to Romans 11. And at the end of Romans 11, he sort of makes a summarizing statement. So you could read that passage because it's Paul wrestling with a similar kind of question. Now, the other thing I would say is this. In the Bible, it's clear that God wants us to want to do what we ought to do. He does not want to force us to do what we ought to do. He wants us to want to do what we ought to do. Just like a fiancé wants his fiancé to marry him because she wants to. He doesn't want her to marry him because somebody has a gun to her head. He wants her to want to do that. And there may be some aspect of that in answer to the question God wants us to do. He wants us to want to do what we ought to do. And that there may be some part of that answer. That's known as the free will defense of theodicy. But the short answer to that question is the greatest theologians of the last 2,000 years have wrestled with that question and come up short. And one more thing I'll say about that. To me, that is one of the proofs that Christianity is true and that the Bible is true and that God is real. Why do I say that? if I understood everything in the Bible, then God could not be infinite because I'm finite. If I understood everything in the Bible, then God could not be infinite because I'm finite. The very fact that I come across things in the Bible that I don't understand, or which even things that unnerve me, is a proof that this really is the infinite and personal God revealing himself. Of course there are going to be things that we don't understand. Tim Keller provocatively says this: if you find yourself always in agreement with God in the Bible, it may be that you are making him in your image. You know, if you make the God of the Bible to kind of fit your perception of what he's like as you're reading the Bible, it may be that you're making him in your image. And he says that's why sometimes when you come to passages and you go, no, I don't like that. Well, that's exactly what you would expect to happen if God really wrote the Bible. For you might not like some things that he said in there. You might not understand some things that he said in there. You might wrestle with and even resist a little bit some of the things that he says in there. Because he's God and you're not. And his ways are not our ways. And his ways are higher than our ways. So I think that's an important thing. You should not be surprised when you come to things in the Bible that baffle you. Or even that unnerve you. Or that you resist. Because if an infinite God has revealed himself in the Word, there are going to be some mysteries there.